Okay, we're going for a bit of a gallop tonight. One of the things we're doing with the covenant, with the covenant, we're splitting the term in two, really. And this first half, we're doing the story of the covenant, so really the story of the Bible. The second half, we're going to do the so what. One of the problems with doing a Bible overview is that it's quite difficult to apply it as you go along, because obviously things somewhat change as you move towards the end of the Bible. It's no point now saying, so let's be really regular with our goat sacrifices or whatever, when you've just looked at Exodus, because obviously by the time you get to Jesus, it's a little bit different. So the story part, we've got 2 or 3 weeks left, and I want to speed it up a bit. So tonight we're going to go from Exodus to the exile, which means we're going from the second book of the Old Testament right the way through to pretty much the end of the Old Testament. Okay, so it's going to be a bit of a gallop, and inevitably we're going to skip over loads of detail. But I think the big picture, hopefully, is relatively easy to get a grip on. So, you'll remember last time we left the Israelites at Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai was the name of the mountain where they were given the Ten Commandments and where God entered into a special relationship with them, the covenant. It was the second edition, if you like, of the covenant of grace. The same covenant, the same arrangement that God had made with Abraham back in Genesis. He kind of reissued, updated, same deal but updated, with all the Israelites at Sinai. And if you just open the literally probably the first page of the Bible, the contents page, okay, so I don't even need to get to Genesis 1. To some of you this will be completely old hat, but I just thought it might be worth, I suppose, explaining a little bit about how the Bible's put together. Look at the contents page that's in Bible order rather than alphabetical order, which is what I'm looking at. Okay, so Genesis, the first book, obviously is the book of beginnings, both the beginning of the world and the beginning of the story of Israel, the covenant story with Abraham. Then Exodus through Deuteronomy, they're all books that take place whilst Moses is alive. They're all the books of the story of the escape from Egypt up to the edge of the promised land. Okay, so by the end of Deuteronomy, Moses has got the Israelites and they're looking sort of over the border. And in fact, it's quite a sad, it's quite a moving story, really. The last part of Deuteronomy, God takes Moses up to a mountain just outside Israel and shows him the promised land. Moses isn't going to be allowed to go in because of particular sins he's committed on the journey. And so God shows him it and basically says, well done, Moses, you've got them to the edge, but you know you can't go in. So God takes him up to the top of the mountain, shows him the view, and then Moses dies up there with God, and God buries him. It's an extraordinary story, really. So that's sad, but at the end of Deuteronomy, they're almost there. And so it falls to Joshua, look down the next book of the Bible, Joshua, to actually take them in. Joshua is Moses' kind of second in command, lieutenant, if you like, and he is the one who leads the Israelites to conquer the land of Canaan. He's relatively successful, so the book of Joshua is more or less a success story. But by the time we get to the next book, the book of Judges, Joshua has died, and there's no one leader over Israel anymore. And so what happens is that the Israelites are more or less moving towards more unfaithfulness. Okay, they're getting less godly, less obedient. They haven't quite finished conquering the land, and the book of Judges, it was meant to be about them taking the whole land. They're kind of in, they've got a bridgehead, they've established their bases all around the land, but there's still Philistines there and Hittites over here, and they haven't quite sort of conquered everything. And because they're disobedient, one of the consequences, one of the things we learn in the book of Judges, is that actually they never fully get the land that was promised to Abraham. Just flick on to the book of Judges, and we'll look a short extract from it, Judges 2. If someone gets a page number... Oh, you haven't got church Bibles. Never mind. Judges 2 and verse 11. So Israel are in the land. What do we find out? The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. Baals throughout most of the rest of the Old Testament are the names of various false gods. They abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them and bowed down to them. And they provoked the Lord to anger. Okay, so they abandoned God. How does he respond? Well, he responds with anger. They're breaking the covenant. So they serve other gods. Verse 14, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and the curses fall. He gave them over to plunderers, who plundered them. He sold them into the hands of their surrounding enemies, so they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out to battle, that is, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned, and as the Lord had sworn to them. See, there's that covenant language. He's warned them what would happen if they disobey, if they aren't faithful. Verse 15, he's sworn it to them. That's covenant language. You know, he made that oath at Sinai, and they were in terrible distress. Then what happens, verse 16, he raises up a judge. A judge is a kind of military leader, and for a while things will go well. So these are some of the famous stories, you know, Gideon in his fleece, Samson and Delilah pushing down the, you know, the temple, that sort of thing. It's a rollicking book, Judges. And for a while, when a judge comes along, a military leader, things pick up. And then the judge dies, the people disobey God again, and round. It's a kind of downward spiral. It's like something going down the plug hole in the bath. You watch them plunge further. And the end of Judges ends in sort of mass rape, murder. It's pretty much the most disgusting chapter of the Bible, really. But if you flick to the very last verse, right through the book of Judges, despite the fact the author, whoever wrote Judges, we don't know, the author knows these guys are covenant breakers, but he's got a bit of an explanation for it. Very last verse, Judges 21 and verse 25. In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Everyone does what's right in his own eyes, i.e. makes their own mind up about morality, how they're going to live, what gods they're going to worship. Why? Well, because there's no king. And that verse, almost alone, sets up really the second half of the Old Testament. That the big deal from now onwards, and the big deal for us this evening, is going to be this question of the king. If Israel is going to be obedient, they're going to need a king to lead them, a king to point them in the right direction, a king to keep them on track. Now, there's a bit of a debate about whether Israel should have just been okay without a king anyway, and blah, blah, blah. If you sort of know about that debate, I'm afraid we're just going to skip it tonight. If you don't know about it, forget the last two sentences. But one thing that's clear is that God has set out already, so before the time of the judges, he set out how kings are meant to live. So just flick back to that, the Mosaic Covenant, so Deuteronomy, which is one of the books where the sort of detailed laws of the covenant are given. And chapter 17. Deuteronomy literally means the second law. It's the second time the law was given after the Israelites bodged up the first time with the golden calf. So Deuteronomy more or less is full of the laws that they're meant to obey. And if you look at 17, and particularly verses 14 to 20, when you come to the land that Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me like all the nations around me, you may indeed set a king over you, okay, there's a permission, whom the Lord your God will choose. But what kind of king should it be? Okay, this is the thing. It's not meant to be a king just like any other nation. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Okay, so it's got to be an Israelite. And then he's warned against three G's, verse 16. He must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said to you, never return that way again. And he shall not require many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, and nor shall he acquire for himself excess silver and gold. Okay, two verses, three things spelt out. Not too much gold. Okay. Not too many girls. Okay. Many wives, and I couldn't decide. Initially, I went, yeah, Gigi was an option. Too many Gigi's horses. I actually went for guns in the end. The reason, horses, they don't race them, okay, so it's not like kind of Aintree or something. Horses pull chariots and ride warriors, so horses are weapons, basically. The idea is he's not meant to stock up his armory with these horses and chariots so he can go sort of destroying everybody. He's not meant to marry millions of women. Often marriage will be about alliances with other nations, and he's not meant to stockpile loads of gold. All those things, I think, in a way, are ways of being self-reliant. Okay, you've got so much money, you can look after yourself. You've got so many troops and weapons, you can sort of beat up the other nations, and you've got so many wives, you've sort of married the daughters of all the other kings around you to keep you safe. That would be the way the non-Christian kings, as it were, did it. So he's been warned to be different. And how is he going to stay different? Verse 18. For those of you who complain about memory verses or say you can't learn a verse a fortnight, we might do this one maybe. The king, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write out for himself in a book a copy of this law approved by the Levitical priests, and it'll be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God. He had to copy out by hand the whole of the Old Testament so far. This law doesn't just mean that little bit in Deuteronomy 17. The law is the name for everything written by Moses. So Genesis through to the end of Deuteronomy. The king had to sit down and then have it checked by the Levites, who were the kind of priestly type people, in case they made a mistake. Just interesting, they made him do it by hand himself. He couldn't get a scribe to do it. That's part of what being a good king was. And obviously the point of that is so that the king remembers that he is deputy to God. Okay, it's actually sort of God who's ruling through his word above the king, and then there's the king, and then there's the Israelites under him. And the big point really is that he shouldn't be a king like the other nations. He's got to be different. Okay, he's got to be a God-type king, not a king like sort of Babylon would appoint. What happens next? Well, the story of 1 Samuel tells of the first attempt of a king. King Saul is the first king of Israel. He's the kind of king that you'd appoint if you chose. You know, he was tall, he was handsome, he was strong, he was good at fighting. And he's a complete disaster. We're going to skip his story basically entirely. But all the way through 1 Samuel, we hear about Saul. And then in 2 Samuel, we meet David. Okay, and it's with David that the story of the kings really gets cooking. So I guess our most important passage this evening, 2 Samuel and chapter 7. Why is he bringing that up? Any questions so far? It's basically a story so far, but happy with what's happened? Great. 2 Samuel 7.
Sorry, John.
Yeah.
This might be this is a lot of the reason for that, but like there's a point in which like the king was like sort of kept the covenant.
Hold for. Yeah, good work. Yeah. So, I mean, one thing I will say on that now is one of the reasons why the king was to have the law written down and by him and sort of with him at all times was that if Israel was going to be... Remember last week with the Mosaic Covenant, we finished by sort of talking about the fact that Israel is meant to be different from all the other nations. So that, you know, they dress weird to stand out, but also their morality was meant to be different. Well, the point of the king is to lead them in that direction. So if the people are going to be different, the king's going to have to be different. But we're going to come back to exactly that point, Tom. So 2 Samuel 7, and this is the moment. David's been sort of appointed king. He survived Saul. Saul's died, and it's all come together. If I let's just get a different voice, can someone else read perhaps verses 8 through to verse 10? That'll do fine. 2 Samuel 7, 8 to 10. This is God telling Nathan what to say to David. Nathan's a prophet. Great.
Now then, tell my servant David, this is what the Lord Almighty says. I took you from the pasture, from following the flock to the ruler of my people, Israel. I have been with you wherever you have gone, and I have put up all your enemies from before you. Now I will make your name great, like the names of the greatest known there. And I will provide a place for my people, Israel, and I will plant them so they can have a home of their own, and they will not be disturbed. Wicked people will not oppress them anymore, as they did at the beginning.
Great, thanks. Okay, it's the making of the next edition of the covenant. It's not, the covenant word isn't used here, but elsewhere when talking about this incident, it is used. And if you, well, in fact, before you turn over, okay, if you have turned over, what blessings would you expect? Okay, what are the covenant blessings? What would God be promising? Okay, if it's going to be the next edition? Okay, we've had three P's so far. a place to live.
Okay, and what do you see? Verse 10, I will appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them so they dwell in their own place.
Okay, so that's the first P. What else has he promised all along?
Presence.
His presence. Can you see that anywhere in those verses?
Start of verse 9. I've been with you, David, wherever you went.
Okay. So there's a sort of hint of it there. Presence, we'll just hold fire on a little bit. Third one. People.
Okay. What has God promised to David? Verse 10 again. I'll appoint a place for my people, Israel, and will plant them in the land. Same verse makes both points, really. And from now on, they won't be disturbed anymore. They won't be afflicted by enemies.
Okay, he's going to have people in that paradise land. And if you look down to verse 13,
the presence thing begins to come out a bit more. This is a theme that's going to pick up in a minute. But talking about David's son, Solomon, he shall build, says God, a house for my name.
I.e., Solomon's going to build a temple. And God's going to come and live with them in a special way. So the three P's are there, although the presence one's certainly going to be developed more. What's new? You know, why is God bothering? You know, he doesn't just sort of get bored every couple hundred years and just reissue the covenant. Every time he adds something, he tweaks something, he develops something. This time the development is verse 12 to 14.
So, talking to David, God says, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who should come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. Okay, so when you die, I'm going to raise up your offspring, who's going to be one of your own genetic children, as it were, come from your body, and I'll establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, that's the temple, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son.
What's new is that the covenant king is back. Okay, so far there's been no one person on whom the covenant has been focused, a sort of leader of the covenant, as it were. I mean, the promises have been made to people. Okay, someone's got to hear them, like Abraham heard them. But he didn't have a particular role in the covenant. He wasn't kind of head of it or anything. At Sinai, Moses was the one who heard it. He was the one up the mountain, and it was made with all the people, but there was no head of the covenant type figure. From now onwards, the king, okay, the fact there's going to be a king over the people is going to be involved in the whole deal. Okay, so from now onwards, a specific person, one person, will be representing. What will he do? Well, he'll be responsible for building God's temple. He'll rule forever. And his relationship with God, verse 14, I will be to him a father, and he to me a son. You read that, and I suppose if you've sort of been a Christian a while, you instantly start thinking Jesus. Like, oh, I was talking about Jesus. Ultimately, of course, he is. Okay, everything's about Jesus in the Bible. But first and foremost, he's talking about Solomon, who was David's son.
It was Solomon who built the temple, literally, verse 13. It was Solomon who was literally flesh and blood, verse 12, of David, his offspring from his flesh. And therefore, verse 14,
it was Solomon who was God's son. One of the, you know, the, like the, if you ever see the Queen's proper title, she's not just the Queen of England or whatever, is she? She's got this kind of massive, long Queen of, you know, England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales, Defender of the Faith, I don't know what it is. On and on and on it goes, loads of titles. And she's also the, you know, Duchess of this. And anyway, it's the same with the kings of Israel. He's the King of Israel. But one of his other titles was Son of God. Okay, and Son of God, all the way through the Old Testament, is a name for the king, the human king of Israel. It doesn't mean that they are literally divine, obviously. David is a flesh and blood, he died. Solomon, flesh and blood. But all these people are, all these kings in this line are sons of God. And that's going to be really important later on in the Bible. When Jesus walks around claiming to be the Son of God, actually, the first thing he's claiming to be isn't the second person of the Trinity, although he obviously is that. He's claiming to be David's great descendant, the king of Israel. So I suppose slightly confusingly or counterintuitively, often when in the New Testament, in the Gospels, when Jesus claims to be the Son of God, often he's claiming to be a human king. And actually, it's when he claims to be Son of Man that he's claiming to be God, because Son of Man in Daniel is a divine figure. That's a bit of an aside. But just stick in your head that Son of God is a title for the king, because it'll come up later in our little Bible study. Anyway, the king's back. We've been waiting for a king. We had Adam as king. Abraham was told in Genesis 17 that kings would come from your body, but we've not had one. From now onwards, people, presence, the paradise or the place, and a king, the covenant king. Good. Just look down the sheet. What do you think of this? If you look at those verses I've put on the sheet, under the little title, Which King? So the covenant's established. This is another passage dealing with the same covenant. Verse 11 of Psalm 132. The Lord swore to David a sure oath from which he will not turn back. One of the sons of your body I will set on your throne. If your sons keep my covenant and my testimonies that I shall teach them, their sons also shall sit on your throne. Okay, a little summary of the covenant made with David about how his children will rule, or his descendants will rule. Just in groups, literally you've got a minute and a half on this, tops. Is it conditional, this covenant, or unconditional? Conditional or unconditional? Round the table, have a discussion, and then we're going to vote. What are we doing? This table, conditional, unconditional? Both, okay. What was your vote? Both.
Wait, the Bible contradicts itself. She's doing natural quiz.
she's been badly trained, to be fair. So, both. Yeah, I just want to highlight again this theme that's run through all the covenants, is that they, on the one hand, you read parts of them. Wrong page. Verse 11, the Lord swore to David a sure oath from which he will not turn back. One of the sons of your body I will set on your throne. Okay, you read that. If you didn't read verse 12, you'd be like, right, God has absolutely promised he definitely will be on the throne. If God swears it, God not only swears it, he even says, I swear it and I'm not going to change my mind. It's got to happen. Read verse 12. If your sons keep my covenant and my testimonies that I'll teach them, their sons also forever shall sit on your throne. Whoa, just a minute. If, and if they keep it, okay? If it was if there was no conditions, there's nothing to keep. You know, conditions imply if, you know, do. It was the same with Abraham. Okay, Abraham had to walk before me and be blameless, or believe the Lord. Or he had to get off his backside and get out of Ur of the Chaldees and go to Canaan. On the other hand, God did that whole ceremony, do you remember, with the flaming sort of brazier going through the animals cut in half, and he said, I swear you will get the land. So all the way through the Old Testament, we're getting this kind of, there are conditions, but it somehow also seems to be unconditional. And I'm not going to resolve that yet. We'll resolve it, I think, next week. But that tension needs to be there, because it plays into the question that people often get really confused on. Is the gospel conditional or unconditional? Is God's love conditional or unconditional? Don't try and solve it now. Just file away that there's a problem. A lot of what the Old Testament does is set up tensions where God tells his people things that are true, but they can't quite work out how they can be true. Which is why the gospel in the New Testament is called the mystery being revealed, because there's no way to work it out on the way through. Okay, so God set up David as king, and David, you know, he's got some pretty spectacular failures. You think of Bathsheba, murder, pinching someone else's wife, lying to the people, all sorts. But he, to be honest, he's the sort of example king from then onwards. He's the one who's always held up as the great faithful king, which is pretty good news. You can, you know, God can still smile on you with favour, even if you're a murdering adulterer, you know, who's lied to his people and cheated the prophets and all the rest. So David, paradigm king from now onwards. It all starts to go wrong, though, with Solomon, his son. So that the first one to inherit these promises, the next son of God, the next Messiah, actually. All the kings were anointed. You know, Messiah just means anointed. If you put oil on someone's head, they're anointed. So David was David Messiah or David Christ. Solomon was Solomon Messiah or Solomon Christ. It's the same deal, this promise being passed on. But we'll flick on. We're shooting through the Old Testament. Well, David's dead, and we get to 1 Kings. And 1 Kings, or 1 and 2 Kings, take us right to the end of the Bible, right to the end of the Old Testament, sorry. The prophets slot in along the way in 1 and 2 Kings. So you're pretty much at the end of the story by the time you've got to the end of Kings. And then you sort of have to dot back with Isaiah and Jeremiah and co. And at the beginning of 1 Kings, when David dies and hands over, all looks pretty good. In fact, in many ways, this is the high point of the Old Testament. So chapter 4 of 1 Kings, I put the verses on the sheet at the bottom, I think, yeah. David dies, Solomon takes over, son of Bathsheba, in fact. 1 Kings 4:20, Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. In terms of those P's, you can see the people that promised to Abraham, Judah and Israel were as many as the sand of the sea. It's explicitly what Abraham was told. And they're happy, eating and drinking. You can see the place, so the borders spelt out. You know, it's as big as Israel is ever going to get, right from the east to the west, the north to the south. It's massive. You've got the king. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. What's the one P that's missing? God's presence. One missing P is God's presence. And that is what Solomon sets out to deal with. So if you've got 1 Kings open and chapter 4 we've just read, we're not going to read it because it's incredibly detailed, but look at the chapter title of chapter 5, Preparations for Building the Temple. And then all chapter 5 is about just the prep, getting the logs ready, finding the gold. Chapter 6, he actually builds it on and on and on he goes. Chapter 7, there's a little brief bit where he builds his own palace. But then verse 13, the furnishing the temple, you know, all the stuff that goes inside, on and on, long chapter 8, all about bringing the ark to the temple. Solomon is the one who builds the house for God's name, builds the temple. And the end, the climax of the story, verse 10 and 11. Again, I think I put it on the sheet, yeah. They have this big dedication ceremony, the ark's put in there, and when the priests come out of the holy place, that's the centre of the temple, a cloud filled the house of the Lord, so the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. Where have we seen that cloud before? Why is there a cloud filling it? Desert. Desert, yeah. Remember the fiery cloudy pillar that led the people through the land? The fiery cloudy pillar that sort of camped, and the Israelites camped around it? The fiery cloudy pillar that filled the tabernacle, the tent, at the end of Exodus? Well, here it moves into its permanent home. It's God's glory chariot, glory cloud, coming to rest and live at the centre of Israel. Hence the glory of the Lord filling. Incidentally, it's a picture of the Holy Spirit, really. The Holy Spirit is the person of God who sort of brings God's presence to people. So when you read in the New Testament about the church being the temple of the Spirit, these are the kind of pictures men have in our head. You know, you think how awesome it would have been to actually see the fiery, cloudy pillar, literally see it coming down into the temple. You know, it's so glorious that the priests can't even stand, they have to get out. It's sort of burning with fire and holiness and power. That's what happens when the Spirit comes on the church, both corporately as a group and individually. Your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. Part of what these passages about the glory cloud filling the tabernacle and the temple and everything are meant to do is just expand what a massive thing, expand our view of what it means for the Spirit to dwell in us, because we are now the temple of God. Anyway, again, that's to jump ahead a little bit. Really, at this point, with Solomon, he gets what's going on. Again, on the sheet, verse 23, Solomon, on this great day of dedication, O Lord, God of Israel, there is no God like you in heaven above or on earth beneath, keeping covenant and showing steadfast love to your servants who walk before you. That word steadfast love is the word hesed, covenant love, to walk before you with all their heart. You have kept with your servant David, my father, what you declared to him. You spoke with your mouth and with your hand you fulfilled it this day. What's going on? We've got a people in their great land, many of the stars, God there with them. The covenant's been kept. It's a pinnacle. And it all comes crashing down. So let's just do a little bit of, well, actually, let me, first of all, any questions on the story so far? Are we happy where we've gone? We're about to do some group work.
How come David can build the temple?
He tries to. And if you look back at 2 Samuel, I think it is 2 Samuel 7, he wants to, but he can't because he's a man of blood. And God wants the temple built by a man of peace. I'm not sure if I can find the verses quick enough. It's in 2 Samuel, but I'm afraid I can't find the verses quick enough. Sometime after 7, but I can't find where. He wants to build it. He starts making preparations, and God, through Nathan the prophet, says, no, you're a man of war. I want it to be built by a man of peace. Anything else? Story so far. P. Good stuff. Let's do a quick study, therefore, on what went wrong. 1 Kings 10. And again, in your tables, if you read 1 Kings 10, verse 23, to 11:8. It's the story of what went wrong with King Solomon. Don't go too much detail, so I'll give you 10 minutes for this. and we might not even know that. So have a quick read through it and give a crack to the questions. All right. It's going to get wrong. Right, so Solomon. Right page. He gathers, obviously, the exact three things that have been outlawed in Deuteronomy 17. The guns, the gold, the girls. In particular, you know, the Bible is just such an amazing story. Even if you were, if you were studying it as a bit of literature, it's just amazing the way it's woven together. All these different authors over hundreds of years. You know, he goes and gets the horses from Egypt. It's exactly what he was told not to do. And Egypt, right the way through the Old Testament, is a sort of symbol for everything you're not meant to be. The sort of pre-Christian you, if you like. You remember they were rescued out of Egypt to go to Canaan. So Egypt becomes the picture of beforehand. In the New Testament picture, it's the old you, before you were a Christian. Everything you're not meant to be. So anytime they go trading with Egypt or buying stuff from Egypt or going to Egypt for an alliance in battle, it's always bad news. It's going back to the old ways. And it's what Solomon does. With them being foreign, obviously the point isn't that it's a race thing, it's that they've got foreign gods. The Bible never has anything to say negatively, of course, about marrying across different races or different nations or different skins or different languages. That's all fine. The problem is that they have different gods. It's the pagan marrying the believer. That's the problem. 300 and 700 is pretty, you know, he's not doing it by halves. What exactly is the result? Be precise. There you go. What was in my head? What did you get for that one? According to verse 4, what's the result? Forget the exact and the precise bit for a minute because it sounds aggressive. Okay. His heart wasn't fully devoted to God. So, what did I put exactly, precisely, whatever? What's the point that the verse is trying to get across? Has he become a pagan? No. It's not that God has gone. He hasn't sort of started saying, look, I don't believe in, you know, Yahweh anymore. Okay, it's that he's not wholly devoted. His heart isn't fully devoted. That's the Christian is someone who's fully devoted to God. And Solomon's heart is now 60% devoted to God or whatever.
That's the problem. And it is just interesting that, you know, when do they become a problem in verse 4? Well, it's only as he grows older. Maybe in his youth, I don't know, he could sort of tell himself, oh, I'll be fine. But actually, as he grows older, inevitably, the pull of being married to people of different religion pulls him after their gods. And so, what's going to happen if he breaks the covenant? The curse is going to fall, which is exactly what does happen. So it's the next section of chapter 11. I've printed it out on the sheets as well. The Lord appears to Solomon a third time, a final time. Since this has been your practice, and you've not kept my covenant and my statutes that I've commanded you. Okay, so you've broken the covenant. There's the conditions. I will surely tear the kingdom from you and give it to your servant. Yet for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it in your days, but I'll tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem that I have chosen. Now, hear the significance of this covenant with David, the Davidic covenant. David's covenant kicks in. Who do the curses fall on? In that little passage, who do the curses fall on? Two correct answers.
The people.
Do you see that? Yeah. The kingdom is going to be torn in two. Okay, do you remember Israel's made up of 12 tribes, 12 brothers? Reuben, Simeon, Levi, all the rest of them. And from now on, it's going to be a divided kingdom. So Solomon's sin leads to punishment for the people. It's because he's the representative, he's the focal point, the head of the covenant. So actually, the curses fall on the people, as well, of course, as falling on the king himself. He's going to have the kingdom torn from him. There's a slight delay, it goes to his son, but it, you know, essentially, the curses fall both on the king and on his people. And that's a massive sort of massive important point for the rest of the Bible. It is the king who represents his people. So we see the kingdom split in two. Actually, it passes on to Rehoboam. Solomon's son is Rehoboam. Rehoboam survives not very long and is basically a complete idiot and manages to divide the kingdom. If you look on the little map on the right-hand side, from now onwards, so really from 1 Kings 10, 11 onwards, it's where things, if you're reading through these books of Kings and Chronicles, things start to get complicated. We start to get confused. Because on that little map, what happens is that the land that we've always called Israel or Canaan splits into two lands. One called Judah, you can see towards the sort of bottom-ish of the picture on the left, and one called Israel above it. Actually, they split basically 10 tribes to two. Judah and Benjamin in the south, and then all the other tribes in the north. Simeon is a bit of a one-off, but we'll leave that. So the land of Israel is split in two, and confusingly, the northern kingdom carries on being called Israel, whereas the southern kingdom, which has got Jerusalem in it, is called Judah, after the sort of dominant tribe that stays down there. The map's not printed very clearly, but if you see the sort of thing that looks like a castle in the middle, that's basically the border. And you can see below that is Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is the sort of top of Judah, it's the capital city. Jerusalem and Judah and David's line all stay together in the south. So they're the one who keep the covenant promises. So Rehoboam keeps some of the kingdom, two tribes, and he passes on to his kids and his kids and his kids. That gets passed down. David's line is protected. But in the north, well, I mean, almost literally all hell breaks loose. In the north, moving on to the next little section there, they're continually unfaithful. They haven't got the covenant promises, because the covenant promises are about Jerusalem and the king ruling there and the temple. That's all in the south. They're sent prophet after prophet, so it's in the northern kingdom that people like Elijah minister, or Elisha, Hosea, and they just ignore them. And so pretty quickly, things start going downhill. The sort of world power at the time is Assyria. And Assyria come in and annihilate them. The map, again, that second map. What happens in 722 BC is the Assyrians invade Israel and basically wipe it off the map. There are two arrows. It's quite hard to see. There's a little key in the top, but there are two arrows. If you start with a sort of solid one, what you'll see is that it sort of begins in Samaria. Samaria is the capital city of the Northern Kingdom. And the Israelites, okay, the Northern Kingdom people, are just taken out of their land. So they follow that arrow up, round, round, and they end up out towards that little place past Assyria, out towards Ecbatana and Media. They're just taken into exile. The king gets rid of them. The Assyrian way of sort of adding people to the empire was if they conquered a country, let's say the king of Assyria conquered England and conquered France and conquered Scotland, he'd get all the Scottish people and put them in France, all the French people and put them in England, and all the English people and put them in Scotland. So everyone's kind of muddled up and it's all gone wrong. And that way he could keep control of his empire. And that's what he does with Israel. And so he bungs another load of people into the land that was Israel. And yeah, there are a few stragglers lying on and they all sort of intermarry and they become the Samaritans. So when you get to the New Testament and Jesus and how, you know, the Good Samaritan and the fact that the Jews hated the Samaritans, this is who he's talking about. It is these remnant people who are kind of sort of half Jewish but married with invading forces and all sorts of others, and they're gone. Basically, they're just not in the rest of the story. There's a few prophecies, they'll come back, but for all intents and purposes, they're gone. Judah, just over the page, the southern kingdom, Judah, it goes a bit better. It certainly lasts longer. And every now and again in Judah, you get a faithful king who pops up and, you know, there's a bit of a revival. The king leads the people back to God, but then he dies and it all goes wrong again. It's rather like the book of Judges. And eventually a king called Manasseh comes along, who is the worst of the worst. He's the sort of pit. And he's so steeped in idolatry that eventually God's patience runs out. You know, he warns them. He sends other prophets. You know, think of all the other prophets in the Bible. They ignore them. 2 Kings 21. Finally, the sword falls. The Lord said by his servants to the prophets, because Manasseh, king of Judah, has committed these abominations. Okay, he set up shrines to other gods and all the rest, and has done things more evil than all the Amorites did who were before him. The Amorites were the people who lived in Israel before the Jews, and has made Judah also to sin with his idols. Therefore, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I am bringing upon Jerusalem and Judah such a disaster that the ears of everyone who hear it will tingle. Tingle, man, I'll make your ears tingle, it's going to be that bad. They'll be shocked. Why? Well, because Manasseh has made the Jewish people, the people of God, become even more unholy than the Gentiles. You know, it's kind of like, it's basically like God saying to them, to be honest, you're worse than Nazis. So, you know, why should I be faithful to you anymore? The Amorites were busy killing their kids and child sacrifice and all the rest. That's why God kicked them out in the first place. And now the Jews are worse. Terrible time. So why does God curse Judah? Well, again, it's the same principle. Verse 11. Because Manasseh has committed these abominations, therefore I'm going to bring disaster on Jerusalem. So the first reason he cursed it is because of the king's sins. Okay, the first thing the king does wrong is in his representative role, he is such a bad sinner that the punishment are going to fall on his people. Okay. But also, he has a second effect. It's not just that he, on his own, sins so badly that the sort of curse spills onto his people. What else happens? Verse 11. He has done things more evil than the Amorites did, who were before him, and has made Judah also to sin with his idols. He also infects his people. He leads them astray. So he's both their representative and their sort of influencer, if you like. Basically, he gives them a guilty status and he leads them into having sort of corrupt hearts. It's a picture. Well, what's that remind us of? Where have we met that already? Adam, exactly. Remember what Adam did? When Adam broke that initial covenant of works, what did he give to his people, to all of us? Well, we inherit his guilt and also we inherit corruption. So we're guilty because of Adam's sin, which is part of humanity, and humanity is guilty, but also we inherit this sort of disease of sin. And Manasseh is, if you like, at the end of the Old Testament, it's almost like we're back where we started. He's kind of like a, you know, an Adam again who's bodged it all up. And as God promises, the curses do fall. So this time it's a bit later. It's 586. And let's look at the last, almost the end of the Old Testament, 2 Kings 24 and 25. By this stage, Assyria has been destroyed by Babylon. So Babylon are the big players there, the kind of world empire at the moment. And, you know, God is patient. He gives them lots of chances. So Nebuchadnezzar, who's the king of the Babylonians, kind of raids and takes some of them into exile, but he doesn't destroy the country. And you'd think that would be enough to shake them up to sort of repent, but they don't. And so eventually Nebuchadnezzar comes and he annihilates them. Judah this time. He's already taken the north. And the curses fall. Well, chapter 24, verse 14. Nebuchadnezzar, that's the he carries away all Jerusalem and all the officials and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen and the smiths. None remained except the poorest people of the land. Curses fall on the people. Verse 16, the king of Babylon brought captive to Babylon all the men of valor, 7,000 of the craftsmen and the metal workers, 1,000, all of them strong and fit for war.
The Babylonians have got a slightly different policy. They're quite happy to leave the sort of people they think are the sort of scumbags in the land. They don't really care about them. So what the Babylonians do is take away all the people they think might be useful. So they take the royal officials and the princes, they take the priests and scribes, they take the soldiers and the generals and the craftsmen. That's why people like Daniel, Daniel goes off in this exile, Ezekiel, some of these guys who are sort of the cream of Israelite society, as it were. They get deported off. The only sort of slight hope is they don't get scattered everywhere. They all get taken to Babylon. So they all sort of still know they're Jews. They live together as Jews. The Jewish line is preserved, as it were.
And also there's still a decent amount of them left behind in Jerusalem, in Judah. But the people are kicked out. The paradise land is a nightmare. Verse 3, famine spreads across the city. There's no food in the land. Verse 9, he destroys all the houses. God's presence, the temple. Well, Nebuchadnezzar destroys the temple. Have a look at verse 9. He, Nebuchadnezzar, burned the house of the Lord and the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem. Or verse 13, the pillars of bronze that were in the house of the Lord, the stands and the bronze sea that were in the house of the Lord, the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, broke in pieces and carried away to Babylon. If you read the whole of those two chapters, they ransack the temple, they take the Ark of Covenant, they take everything that's worth anything, and then burn the thing to the ground. It's the fall of Jerusalem. And with it, goes our fourth and final part of the covenant king. A couple of them get sort of nailed on the way. Verse 6 and 7 take care of the last one. They capture the king, Zedekiah this is, and brought him to the king of Babylon at Riblah, and they passed sentence on him. They slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, put out the eyes of Zedekiah, bound him in chains, and took him to Babylon. So it's all a bit of a disaster. This story that's meant to sort of be about God filling the earth through Israel with people in his image, with his king in charge of them, him present to bless them. It just bombs at the end of the Old Testament. And in many ways, we're back in the same place as Genesis 3. We've had all this time, and actually, where are we? We've still got no presence of God on earth, really. No people listening to him. No place where his people dwell, and no king. But the one thing we have got that we didn't have straight after the fall is we've got the covenant promises. And the fact that, to some extent at least, these promises, this covenant, has had a sort of sound of unconditionalness about it. That's a word. The fact that it sounded, that God has always seemed sort of confident that it'll work out. Well, that makes the Old Testament not end in complete sort of no hope, despair. The promises are what fuels the hope of the Jews from now onwards. So just on the back page, I've given an example of that. All along, there have been some Jews who are faithful. We don't want to get the impression that nobody, ever believed or no one ever obeyed. Of course, there are the Daniels and the Isaiahs and Jeremiahs and co. And these kind of people,
They've got a hope, and their hope is it's all about the covenant. They know God has promised to David that David will and his descendants will have a kingdom. And if you're going to have a king, you've got to have a land for him to rule over and a people for him to rule over. And so the Jewish hope focuses on this hope that the king will rule, or if you like, the Messiah will rule. They start to call him the Messiah, the anointed one. We'll look a bit at the prophets next week. But even when they've got no land, no temple, they cling to the promise of a king. It's not that they're going to be the king. You know, if you're a random Jew sat in Babylon in exile, you're not going to be the king. But you know that if the king comes back, he'll have a people and a kingdom. So you get Psalm 89, I put a few verses from on the sheet, that they sing. I will not remove, this is the Lord says, I will not remove from David my steadfast love or be false to my faithfulness. I will not violate my covenant or alter the word that went forth from my lips. Once for all I've sworn by my holiness, I will not lie to David. His offspring shall endure forever, his throne as long as the sun before me. Like the moon it shall be established forever, a faithful witness to the skies. But now you've cast off and rejected, you're full of wrath against your anointed. As they sing that song, verse 38 is the situation. We don't know who wrote it, we don't know where he is, but he's in trouble, whoever wrote the psalm. He's a random Israelite, he's not a king or anything. He's either in exile or he's under siege, or, you know, God, you are angry with us, you've rejected us, things aren't going, the world's a mess. But, verse 33 to verse 37, I remember you have promised you will give a king. And actually that pattern is exactly the same pattern as we've got now. What the faithful Jewish guy was praying there was, Lord, let your king come, which is what we pray week by week in the Lord's Prayer. Lord, let your kingdom come. Lord, let your king come. It's the same thing. We've obviously not looked at the new covenant and Jesus, and things have shifted on massively when we get to him. But in a sense, we are like the Israelites in exile. Peter uses that sort of terminology, calls us aliens or exiles or strangers. Because to an extent still as Christians, you know, we're not where we belong. We're not home. Okay, you know, heaven is our home, or in fact the whole earth will be our home, but it's not prepared for us yet. It's not finished yet. We do live with the right people. You know, we've got church as our family, but actually we also live among and within millions of people who basically hate Jesus. So we're not kind of finished yet. So what's our hope? Our hope is that the king comes. God's got no reason to rescue us. I mean, he's not obliged to rescue you or me in particular. But he has promised he will make Jesus king, and Jesus has to have people, and he has to have a place to rule over. And so the hope of the Christian, exactly the same as the hope of the Jew at the end of the Old Testament, Lord, let your king come. Because when he comes, I can find a place as one of his people in his paradise. That's a lot of Old Testament. Okay, that's basically almost the entire Old Testament in one evening, Exodus to exile. And we will spend the rest of the time in prayer. But before that, any sort of big picture, but any questions, clarifications on the either on the story or the particular covenant theme? I knew someone would ask that, and I don't know the answer. I sat there this afternoon thinking, what's the answer to that? I even asked James Buchanan, who also doesn't know the answer. It is confusing. So God says to Solomon there, I will give you one tribe. I will give to your son one tribe. And the main tribe is Judah. So the tribe that dominates the south is Judah. So I think that's what he's talking about. But if you look at, just flip back to 1 Kings 11, the reason it's confusing he warns him in 1 Kings 11,
I'll only give you one tribe. 1 Kings 12 over the page. Rehoboam is the son. Okay, so Solomon dies, everything's okay with Israel, they're all 12 together still, although they know it's going to go wrong. Rehoboam takes the throne. Verse 3 of chapter 12, they sent and called him and Jeroboam, who's just a sort of, he's basically a sort of a royal official who's fled away. They all come together, and the elders of Israel say to Rehoboam, verse 4, your father made our yoke heavy. Okay, it was hard work under Solomon. Now, therefore, lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke on us, and we will serve you. He said to them, go away for 3 days, then come again to me. So the people went away. Then King Rehoboam took counsel with the old men who stood before Solomon and his father. How do you advise me to answer the people? Okay, they've said, make life easier. All this temple building is too hard work. They said, if you will be a servant to this people today and serve them and speak good words to them when you answer them, they will be your servants forever. Okay, good advice. Okay, be kind to them. Your father was too harsh on them. Verse 8, he abandoned the counsel with the old men gave and took counsel with young men who'd grown up with him. They said, verse 10, this is how you should speak. Your father made our yoke heavy. You lighten for us. You should say, my little finger is thicker than my father's thighs. That's probably a euphemism, but we won't go there. Now, whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips. I'll discipline you with scorpions. So basically, Rehoboam says, you think it's hard? I'm going to make it a nightmare for you. And so they rebel. And in verse 16, when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to him, the people answered the king, what portion do we have? To your tents. When the battle actually kicks off, though, you expect it to be Judah against the other 11. But verse 21, when Rehoboam came to Jerusalem, he assembled all the house of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin. And so Benjamin and Judah fight against the rest of the Israelites. And that's where the split actually happens. So what I don't know is how it's moved from 1 to 2, or why it's moved from 1 to 2. And if you want just more confusion as well, if you were to put Simeon on the map, Simeon actually is a territory sort of fully within the kingdom of Judah, as in it's enclosed in the tribe of Judah's land. So what happens to Simeon as well? No idea. So I've basically answered a question with more confusion. But the way the Bible then presents it is Judah and Benjamin and the other ones. Simeon in the south just seems to sort of disappear off the map somehow, I'm not sure. Anyone else want confusing further with other questions? Happy? Cool. Okay, well, let's finish by praying. A couple of things worth mentioning. The meal. Is anyone out there? How can I know God? How can I find God? Still can't remember the title. On the Wednesday, the second Wednesday in November, so do pray for that. Praying for students at the moment as they move around looking for churches, and pray they settle. If it's God's will, we could have some settle with us. And also, kind of slightly hot off the press news, Helen's been coordinating a search for venues, and there's a possibility. I'm sorry to say this, isn't it? Yeah, I think so. There's a possibility. We went round the Joseph Wright Centre the other day, who were really friendly, and it looks quite positive. So you can pray for the search to be successful. We really need more space, particularly for children. And Joseph Wright looks quite a good option. They're considering whether to, you know, how much to charge us, whether to offer us a place, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, pray we find a good venue.